For more presentations like this, visit www.xenos.org.
Looks like the Buckeyes could use a little prayer tonight. May not be walking in the Spirit down there. Anyway, we're back here in Hebrews 11, probably the supreme chapter in the Bible on the nature of faith. And after talking about it in the abstract, where he defines faith here in verse 1, being sure of what we hope for and certain of what we do not see, which we studied last week, we saw this notion of being certain about the unseen is that we believe the unseen portion of the universe is real. That's where God, we can't see God, we see signs of God, we can't see people's spirits, but we can sense and detect that they have a spiritual dimension. Most of the important part of life is in the unseen portion, the spiritual portion. And we saw that we need to believe that this spiritual dimension to life is real enough to act on. So it's not just an academic belief, but it's something that we're ready to step out and depend on, that it's real, that we're not just imagining this or telling ourselves this. And that's what faith is all about. We saw in verse 6 that without faith it is impossible to please God. Anyone who wants to come to God must believe that God exists and that He rewards those who sincerely seek Him. So there is no other way, according to the Bible, to please God other than faith. God wants us to trust Him. And believing specifically that He is, what He is, and that He will reward those who seek Him. In other words, that He's good. And so trustworthy in the personal sense. We don't have to be afraid of Him. Well, he went on then and said, back up to 2, this is what the ancients were commended for. By faith we understand that the universe was formed at God's command, so that what is seen was not made out of what is visible. That is, everything we see today came out of nothing that we could see before. I think this is a very remarkable statement. You know, you may not be aware of this if you haven't studied comparative religion, but there are lots of creation narratives, creation stories in different religious complexes. Most of them have the gods going out with, you know, a saw, a hammer, and a ladder, and tools, and fashioning the world out of existing material. The question of where did that come from never comes up. The Bible is very unique in that we open our Bible and it says, in the beginning God created the heavens and the earth. We have this very, you know, non-primitive concept of God's speaking by fiat, by idea. He would formulate the idea and speak it, and it would come into being, whatever He said. So it's a very different picture than what we find in most religious complexes. And this part here, that there was nothing, and then there was something. I commented last week, only recently has modern science come to share this view about our universe. You know, for the longest time, science believed in, tried to fashion different static state models where the universe has basically always been here. And maybe it was an oscillating universe, and there are all kinds of different pictures that have been formulated. And it's really only in the second half of the 20th century that science has come to accept that that is not possible. That in fact, because of the movement of the whole universe away from each other, we can extrapolate that it all used to be in one place, and this has led to the Big Bang theory of the universe. Some Christians mistakenly believe that the Big Bang theory is anti-God, or that that's against what we're saying in Christianity. I don't think so. I think we're reading it right here. This concept discovered by Albert Einstein, that energy and matter are ultimately interchangeable and can change from one to the other, that matter is energy, was never known before this past century. And it makes it possible, you know, for some of the most amazing findings that are just now coming to light. A lot of the most dramatic discoveries in physics and in cosmology, the study of how the universe came into being, have been made within the past 10 or 15 years. I mean, this is a very fast-moving field. And a lot of it is raising some disturbing questions to naturalists, to atheistic thinkers who don't want to admit the possibility of a personal creator God. And I mentioned last week that we would take a little time to think about this. Two important lines of evidence have come to light then just in the past couple of decades, and well, really several number of decades here, but within the past century. The first is what we could call the fine-tuning argument. And this is very recent. This has only come to light in its prominence in the 90s and in the since in the 21st century. So it's very recent. And it's based on recent discoveries. And then, too, I think the Big Bang itself. Both of these seem to confirm that it is not possible to envision a universe that's just been around forever and that we're reading God into this. That in fact there's a beginning point that's very mysterious and suggests that God exists after all. That suggests exactly what this verse says here. Let's look at these, the fine-tuning argument. I've been doing some reading on this over the past few years, and it's really a struggle because I'm not a physicist. So a lot of what they're saying, I can't understand what they're saying. So I try to filter through to some of the more popular presentations of it. I can't back up some of the things I'm saying, so I'm just relying on what the experts are saying. Now, here is a description of the theory by Robin Collins. He says, there are many fundamental parameters in physics which determines what kind of universe this is. Examples include the Planck's constant, the mass and the charge of the electron, the gravitational force constant, the speed of light, and a lot of others too. And it turns out that if some of these numbers are slightly different than what they actually are, their actual values, our universe would not be able to support life. It's virtually impossible that the universe came to have these correct parameters for life by chance, because so many of these numbers must all lie within such a small range of values. Okay, let me give you a couple of examples. Now, that guy that I was quoting, Robin Collins, is a Christian PhD, a professor, but the rest of these guys I'm quoting are not Christians. Okay, I didn't want to quote the Christian physicists because you never know. You know, they might be biasing the information or leaving things out. Let's see what atheistic thinkers have to say about it. This guy, this is Paul Davies, an atheist, okay? Theoretical physicist, a professor in Australia, author of multiple books on this subject, really considered a world authority. He says the initial explosion of the Big Bang, if it had differed in strength by as little as one part in 10 to the 60th power, the universe would have either quickly collapsed back on itself, if it was one tick below that, or would have expanded too rapidly for stars to form. In either case, life would have been impossible. 10 to the 60th power is 10 with 60 zeros after it. He illustrates what this means when you talk about one chance in 10 to the 60th. He says an accuracy of one part in 10 to the 60th can be compared to firing a bullet at a one-inch target on the other side of the observable universe 20 billion light years away and hitting the target. Extremely unlikely. Okay, that's one variable. But the force of this argument comes from the fact that it isn't just like one thing like that. You know, the Big Bang, for it to happen, it had to happen at a certain speed, at a certain force. Very narrowly defined, extremely narrowly defined, and it happened that way. Now, what are the chances of that? Well, 1 in 10 to the 60th power. Now, here's the point, though. Okay, it's much more than that. It's the fact that we have at least a dozen other factors that also have to line up. And so it starts to form a matrix, a converging matrix of necessary conditions, each of which couldn't be the slightest bit different than what it is. And it just reaches the breaking point where, you know, how can something like that happen? For example, still quoting Davies from a different book, calculations by Brandon Carter show that if gravity had been stronger or weaker by one part in 10 to the 40th power, then life-sustaining stars like the sun could not exist. This would most likely make life impossible. And so on it goes. The ratio of electrons to protons has to be what it is. You can read about what the difference is. It's very slight, but very necessary. And if it was different than that, by one part, even in 10 to the 55th power, then heavy molecules would not be formed that are required for life. The expansion rate of the universe, we already mentioned that. The mass of the universe, the total mass of the universe, has to be what it is, according to physicists. Or you would have ended up with a universe of nothing but black holes, if it was slightly more, or nothing but hydrogen, if it was slightly less. It's only at this precise amount of mass that we actually have that it works out this way. So that's very unlikely. Something called the cosmological constant, which I spent way too much time reading about and I still don't understand it, but it has to do with dark energy. That's the most finely tuned of all. One chance in 10 to the 120th power. Here's another illustration of what we're talking about here. This comes from Hugh Ross. He says, what does one part in 10 to the 37th power mean? That's an incredibly sensitive balance that's hard to visualize. Maybe the following analogy will help. Cover the entire North American continent, so this would be the U.S. and Canada, right, with dimes. And then layer them in piles over the whole continents until the pile got taller and taller and reached all the way to the moon, 239,000 miles, mile-high stack of dimes, the size of the North American continent. That's a lot of dimes. To compare this, he says, the money to pay for the U.S. federal government debt would cover 1 square mile less than 2 feet deep. That's how many trillions of dollars? So we're talking about something, the whole continent piled up all the way to the moon. That's a lot of dimes, but we're not done. Next, pile dimes from here to the moon on a billion other continents the same size as North America. Paint one dime red, mix it in with all these other billions of dimes. Blindfold a friend and ask him to pull out one dime. The chance that he would pull the red one out is one chance in 10 to the 37th power. Okay, and that's for one variable. But then when you get this matrix of variables that all have to be there together, you start to realize we're looking at something here that is amazing. Here's a Christian website that discusses this in a somewhat comprehensible article. And they reference a lot of the other places you can read about it, and other authors and so forth, Christian and non-Christian. I thought his article there was pretty good. How would non-believing people answer this whole argument? What is the defense that naturalists or non-theist people that don't believe in God, what do they put up against this? There are basically three main avenues that they try to answer it on, but there's really only one that they seriously camp out on. You know, one is very speculative. Maybe all the physical laws have to be what they are just by their nature, and that there's no possibility that they could be any different than that. I don't know whether that's an answer or just an observation of the way it is. The main defense that non-believers put up against the fine-tuning argument is multiple universes. Okay, so what you basically have argued here is that there is a universe creator, some sort of a, something is creating universes. It's often described like perhaps an ocean of soap in which bubbles apparently from time to time form, and each one is a universe. And there are descriptions like that given. And the number of universes that need to exist other than ours is in the billions of billions. As one author says, virtually infinite number of universes. Why is that? Because it would take that many, having these variables be somewhat different in each one before you would finally get one like ours, just by chance. You'd have to have trillions of trillions of other universes in existence. Now, if you think about this, if you spend some time thinking about this, you'll realize it's kind of inevitable that you would have to propose multiple universes, or you would have to admit this whole thing is like a setup, like it's been set up by someone. Those are kind of your two choices, and sure enough, that's the way the literature breaks down. Let's read, upon seeing the infinite or immense fine-tuning of this universe, they assume the existence of a large number of universes beyond ours with which exhibit no fine-tuning. However, the scientific community currently has no way of knowing whether these alternate universes exist or if they differ from this universe. Now, that's just Jeff Ziering, another guy. Right, I mean, it's not like we can see any of these universes. It's not like we can measure them, hear them in any way, or that there's any scientific evidence whatsoever that there's any universe other than the one we see right here in front of us. But we must assume that they are out there in order to make things work out. These are basically imagined universes. Here's an atheist professor from Pennsylvania. He says, critics often criticize multiple universe theories as totally unsupported by any evidence.
Yeah.
He says, however, as the saying goes, absence of evidence is not evidence of absence. That's true. I mean, just because we have no evidence doesn't mean they couldn't exist. Just because we don't have evidence of the existence of other universes or separate regions of space-time, that does not entail that they do not exist. Yeah, Theodore Grange, another atheist thinker. Okay, you know, and you have to say, well, yeah, okay, I mean, there's no proof that other universes don't exist. On the other hand, there's no evidence that they do exist. What's weird, though, is, you know, that we're going to sit here and say, well, believing that an intelligent, thinking, planning God might have spoken and caused this phenomena to happen, oh, that's way too hard to believe. We could never believe that. That's crazy. Believing in billions of other universes that no one's ever seen and there's no evidence of? No problem. No problem at all. We'd rather believe in that than accept the presence of a creator God. Let's look at the other question that goes right along with this. I mean, we're thinking about the Big Bang. What caused it to happen in the first place? What could have possibly caused an invisible speck in the middle of nothing, of absolute nothing, to suddenly explode into a universe? What causes something like that? What could cause that? Paul Davies again. He says, gravitational theory predicts that under extreme conditions that prevailed in the early universe, space and time may have been so distorted that there existed a boundary or a singularity at which the distortion of space-time was infinite, and therefore through which space and time cannot have continued. In other words, physics predicts that time was indeed bounded in the past. It did not stretch back for all eternity. But I guess it depends how you define time. I mean, something happened before that, right? I mean, what are we saying? So before the Big Bang, I mean, maybe there was nothing. Maybe we couldn't mark time because there was nothing marking time. But I mean, what are we saying that, come on, something was before that. Not according to Davies. He says if the Big Bang was the beginning of time itself, then any discussion about what happened before the Big Bang or what caused it, in the usual sense of physical causation, is simply meaningless. He says, I didn't promise to provide the answers to life, the universe, and everything, but I have at least given a plausible answer to the question I started out with, what happened before the Big Bang? The answer, he says, nothing. So we're to believe that when we look out at the vastness of the universe in which we live, where there are 100 billion galaxies, each galaxy with more than 100 billion stars, and that all of this came out of nothing for no reason. Something, there's nothing, and suddenly there's something. Why? No reason. And he bases the argument on the fact that electrons behave in certain ways within atoms and appear here and there, and we're not sure why, and basically there's no reason, so this is probably what happened with the universe. There's no reason for it. He says that's not unscientific. I think it is. I mean, if something as massive as the universe can happen, an effect like that, without any cause, if we no longer believe in cause and effect, how does science function at that point? Anything can happen. I think it's pitiful. It's pitiful. He says in another piece, even if we don't have a precise idea of exactly what took place at the beginning, we can at least see that the origin of the universe from nothing need not be unlawful or unnatural or unscientific, even though it has no cause. In short, it need not have been a supernatural event. And this is really the bottom line, isn't it? The bottom line is we'll believe anything before we'll admit that this place must have been created by somebody with a very elaborate plan and some very exact ideas about the way things need to be. Truly, if you can believe that, you can believe anything. And why we would consider that more plausible than creation by a thinking being who planned it out this way, I have no idea. This is why we see some of the top thinkers in the world today changing sides. I mentioned Francis Collins last week. Anthony Flew, the British philosopher who has been a champion of atheism since 1950, a really well-known philosopher, author of many books on why there is no God, has just come out in the past couple of years with a new book, There Is a God. And one of the things that moved him off of his stance was this fine-tuning argument. He says, I just have no answer for that. We cannot explain the presence of the universe with what we've learned in physics any other way. He's still not a Christian, but he says there must be a God. And one scholar after another seemed to be admitting this. It's a pretty impressive area. It's worth doing some reading in. I'm sure that it will confuse you. But it would be awesome, but this argument, some of these thinkers, like Collins, thinks this is the most convincing argument there has ever been for a personal, by the way, this is a personal thinking and planning God we're talking about. If you just have God as an impersonal force, it wouldn't explain this. The type of God you imagine has to be adequate to explain the precision and the exactitude that we see in this model. And that means somebody who's thinking, planning, having intent, doing, and working. We're talking about a personal being here. That's the only thing that will explain it. And so guys like Collins say, this is the most powerful argument I've ever heard. He's heard all the other ones before, wasn't convinced by him, but this one got to him. And he changed over and became a Christian believer. And it would be awesome if we could explain this to people. The problem is, it's so complicated, no one can understand it. And so it makes it, it's just the way it is. Anyway, there are many other arguments having to do with the existence of God, the nature of God, and the work that he has done too, including the work he did through Jesus Christ. That's very powerful. I think we have a very remarkable statement here in 11 verse 3 of Hebrews. Very different from what other religious scriptures say. Very different. And perfectly matching what we have learned in recent years. We read that by faith Abel offered God a better sacrifice than Cain did. By faith he was commended as a righteous man when God spoke well of his offerings. And by faith he still speaks even though he's dead. And so he's going to start his survey of figures from the Old Testament times, starting way back at the beginning with the story of Cain and Abel. And he's going to just scope right through the whole Old Testament. And we should look at some of these biographies, because one of the best ways to understand an abstraction, like the kind of abstract definition of faith we talked about last week, is to look at stories of people's lives and how they lived it. And there you can see how it works out in practice. This one is found back in Genesis chapter 4, starting in verse 2. We read that when the two boys, this was Adam and Eve's first two sons, okay, Cain and Abel. It says, when the two boys grew up, Abel became a shepherd while Cain cultivated the ground. When it was time for the harvest, Cain presented some of his crops as a gift to the Lord, whereas Abel also brought a gift, which was the best of the firstborn lambs from his flock. And we read, the Lord looked with favor on Abel and his offering, but on Cain and his offering, he did not look with favor. That used to bother me as a kid. I'd be like, you know, man, he's doing what he can. And, you know, he's a farmer. What's wrong with it? Well, someone said it's because he offered a blood sacrifice of a lamb, whereas Cain is offering the fruit of fruit of his hands, his grain and stuff. I don't think that's right. Look at what it says. It's not the offering. It's not what they offered. It was on Abel and his offering, and on Cain and his offering. It was the guys. There's something about these men themselves that caused a different response from God. To Abel, God said yes. To Cain, God said no. According to the book of Hebrews, chapter 11, it says the reason Abel brought his offering and it was acceptable to God is because he brought it with this attitude of faith that we're talking about. And we can surmise, we can infer from that, that Cain must have brought his offering from the other perspective. Not faith, which is called the perspective of works. Those are the two that are always put up against each other throughout the Bible. Works is the position where you're coming to God and you're saying, okay, God, here, I got this for you, and I think that I deserve to be, you know, accepted by you, and I think this should be good enough to pay my way in, my good works. And God says no to that. That's a proposition he cannot accept. This is the proposition that the readers of the book of Hebrews were coming to God with. They were saying, it's nice that Jesus came, but we also think we have to offer God our works. And that was a falling away from grace. That was really an unbelief on their part. Now, this story is interesting too, because they both gave an offering to God, and actually grain offerings are perfectly accepted in the Old Testament. They have that all over the place, so there's nothing wrong with that part. But it's the point is, there's their outward actions, which were very similar, but God looks right through the action and right into the heart. And that's where he saw a difference between these two guys, the inner heart attitude. Cain, he believed that God existed. He must have, or he wouldn't have been doing this, right? So he's a believer in God. He performed a religious ritual connected with the God of the Bible. So he's like a lot of people today who believe God exists and who go through church rituals on that basis, right? And I think too, yes, I don't think we need to doubt that he was doing this maybe sincerely, that he thought this would work and be good, that God would like it. The problem is, he came on his own terms to God. He didn't come on God's terms. Cain felt like, okay, if I do this, God, for you, then that should be good. And so he's kind of devising, well, I just think I'll come to God this way. And God is saying, yeah, but that's not what I say. That's not how I say you have to come to me. If you want to come to me, it's not up to you to decide that. I'll tell you how you can come to me. And it has to be based on this attitude of faith. Well, the fact that Cain's heart wasn't right comes to light pretty quickly when God reproves him, and the next thing you know, he's got this murderous rage and he kills his brother. Abel, he also believed in God. So they're alike there. And he came to offer what he had, conscious that it would never satisfy, you know, the God of the universe, that this little lamb is nothing to you, God, and I'm just offering it out of appreciation, but I know that this cannot satisfy you. And so that's the humble, dependent offering of yourself to God. I know I don't deserve anything, God, but I'm just offering myself to you anyway. And when we do that, that's the attitude of faith. And that is what God's looking for. And so God said, you've got it right, Abel. Cain, no, you don't. Well, we read that Cain was very angry and his face was downcast. You've seen that probably if you have kids where they get real mad and they won't look at you and stuff. And they're just like, got a real burn going on. And God is like, says, Cain, why are you so angry? And why has your face fallen? He says, if you do well, will not your face be lifted up? So it wasn't too late for Cain. He could change here. And it's interesting. I think that's an interesting statement because, you know, we're aware of the fact, probably most of us, that our attitudes and our beliefs and stuff kind of dictate our actions a lot. We act out of what we believe. We act out of our attitudes that we have. But this is kind of suggesting the other thing, that what we do can have an effect on our attitude. Kind of almost the opposite. And in fact, this is something that's often true. Like we may be saying, you know, I've seen people in a controversy with God before where they're angry at God, just like Cain here. And they just feel like, you know, well, when things change, when I feel differently, then maybe I'll start, you know, go back to living the other way. And a lot of times what God calls on us to do, if our feelings are out of whack, if I'm depressed, if I'm feeling doubt, if I'm feeling anger, is to do the right thing. Continue to do the right thing. And what we'll find then is that I can't by will, like if you just are totally depressed, you can't just say, well, okay, I'm going to be happy now. That's not the way it works, right? You can't just make a willful choice to change the way you feel. But our will can act. What we can decide is what I'm going to do. And so if I decide to do the right thing, to do well, God says, then your countenance will be lifted up and your feelings will follow after. It's a pretty important, I think it's pretty profound. We'll find a lot of application in our own lives for this. Yeah, he could have said, when your face gets lifted up, then you can do well. That's not what he says, is it? He says, if you do well, then your face will be lifted up. Hey, it's like that training we were looking at last week, isn't it? The facts, the face, and the feeling. Feelings follow after. Yeah. And he says, on the other hand, if you do not do well, sin is crouching at the door and its desire is for you. But you must master it. And so God is telling Cain, this is a very dangerous situation you're in here, Cain. Your attitude's bad. You got a bad attitude. And so it's pretty urgent that you do something about this, because what's going to happen if you don't is that you can lose control. In other words, as bad as you feel right now, things could get a lot worse. Things will get a lot worse if you don't realize I can't just sign off and allow myself to walk around with this rotten attitude and not take exception to it. Or act like I can't help it, it's just the way I feel. And if we do that, we're placing ourselves in a position of vulnerability where something a lot worse can happen. God wants us to respond. And when we talked about faith, one of the components mentioned there is faith means that you believe that God is real enough and that the truth is real enough to act on, to do something about. And what will happen when you have a rotten attitude in your life, or a defeated attitude, or a depressed attitude, and you turn to God, is He will often show you this is what you need to do. And it'll be something you can do. It's not like change the way you feel, never think about this thing again. But rather, it'll be, you need to talk to this person about that. You should go to fellowship tonight instead of sitting at home feeling sorry for yourself. You know, you should admit this problem to your friend over here. He'll give you something like that. Maybe you should pick up that book up on this very subject that you've been looking at over on the shelf and not reading. Maybe you should read that after all. And he will give you an action, something you can do. And we need to be willing to do it. Or we're giving ourselves over to something very dangerous, something that can take us over, like what happened with Cain. We read that Cain didn't change his attitude. His anger probably deepened, and it turned against Abel. He says to his brother, "Let's go out into the fields." And while they were in the field, Cain attacked his brother Abel, and he killed him. And so here, before even the first human generation has died, their kids, the first human family, the first murder has occurred in the shadow of the Garden of Eden. The Lord showed up to Cain. He said, "Cain, where's your brother? Where's Abel?" Why do you think God would ask him? What, God didn't know where he was? God knew exactly where he was. That's clear in the narrative that follows. He was giving Cain a chance to confess what he had done here. And even at this point, if Cain had fallen down and just said, "God, I can't believe I did this. I didn't listen to you. And then I did this and I killed him." Now, this whole story would have been different. That's what he's giving him a chance to do. Well, Cain's like, "I don't know. What am I, my brother's keeper?" You can tell his attitude, his heart's really hardened, he's callous, he's acting all cavalier. And God says, "What have you done? Listen, your brother's blood cries out to me from the ground." And so Cain wound up getting banished and had to go out away from his family and stuff. And he was all sad about that. Well, so Cain didn't do too well. And Abel, he wound up dead. But, as with God, ultimately, Abel did pretty well. Okay, I mean, he didn't live a real long life or anything, but he's probably sitting pretty good right now. And you mean, one of the points that we'll see comes up a lot here in Hebrews 11 is that sometimes people that follow God might get messed over. Could be persecuted or even killed. But it's all right. Because, after all, we're probably all going to get killed one way or the other. At least they get to live on with God. And if you believe in the unseen, if you think the unseen world is real, it ain't that bad. Physical death is not the worst thing that can happen at all. There are a lot worse things that can happen than that. And so, that's what he's talking about here. And that's how Abel's blood was kind of calling out to God. And he says, though he's long dead, he still speaks to us by his example of faith. Well, I'm not going to be long-winded tonight. Let's draw some conclusions to what we've seen. We've seen, first of all, that God has provided ample evidence to us of His reality, of his nature, and even of his work. Now, we didn't cover all this tonight. We were just kind of talking about his reality, that he's there. And we were only talking about one or two narrow arguments for that out of the, I would say, 12 to 15 cogent arguments that could have been developed. And then there are the arguments as to the nature of God. That would give us another handful of arguments that are very powerful as well. And then there are the arguments as to the work of God, what he's done in the world. That's very interesting. Those are some of the best, actually. In fact, I'll tell you what I'm going to do. If you want to read some on that, you should go out and pick up that free book we give people called Christianity, the Faith That Makes Sense. It gets into those very arguments. It explains, how do we know that Christ is real? That he's actually the Son of God, that he paid for human sin. God ingeniously set up a system where we can verify that fact still today. Still today. And you can read all about that in that book. You know, when God provides a basis for faith, then we can have a reasonably based faith. You still have to have faith, okay? Where do all of these arguments take us? They just take us up to a certain point, a point where we start to realize, man, you know, this is plausible. This could be true. I get the feeling it might be true. That's about how far it takes us. And from there, that's close enough. And from there, then, there's a moral decision on our part to say, well, I'm going to call out to God and find out if it's true. How much do you really need in order to seek in a direct personal encounter with God? He's given us enough for that. We then are expected to respond by believing him and putting our trust in him. Now, I've described before the role of the apologetics, this whole study of why we think that God's probably there and that he's probably what he says, as being sort of like looking for the peanut butter in your kitchen. And you look around at all the cupboards there. If you're like me, a little absent-minded, maybe you don't know which one it's in, but you kind of look at, it certainly wouldn't be down there with the pots and pans, or over there with the detergent. I don't think it would be in with the glasses and the plates. And you're like, it's probably in this one. Probably in there with the other foods. Now you don't know if it's there. You're not certain that it's there. No one has proven that it's there. But how much evidence do you really need to go over and open the cupboard door and see whether it's there? Not that much. You need basically plausibility. You need the fact that it's more plausible that it's in that cupboard than at any of the others. And that's why you go to that one and open it. And we've got that. And God expects us to come over and open the cupboard door. That's not too much for the ask, he says. And that's when you call out to God. We read in Romans chapter 10 that anyone who calls upon the name of the Lord will be rescued. What an awesome promise. You don't even have to understand the whole thing. You just have to have the intent in your heart that, God, I need to know that the unseen, that your unseen self is real, that you're there, that you are the rewarder of them that come to you, and I'm coming to you. And make yourself known to me. Good enough. That's one of the big applications of this passage. We have to understand, too, then, that this is the only way we can approach God is by believing him and trusting him. If we say to ourselves, well, you know, I don't know about that, but I think I'm just going to try to be a good person, and I think that'll be good enough. No, it won't, Cain. That's not good enough. People will say, well, you know, I don't know about receiving this gift of forgiveness. I think I'll just, you know, I go to a church, so I'll just go to that. That'll be good enough. No, it's not. There's nothing about going to church in any of this. This is a matter of the heart between you and God as personal beings. And he wants a response of faith from you as a person. If we don't do that, If we say, "Well, I just don't feel like it right now," then that's a dangerous situation. We're saying no to something we know we should say yes to. And the danger is that this is going to become sort of a habit in our lives, always saying no, even when in our heart we sense the reality of God, we just say, "I don't know, not now, don't feel like it, no." And the result is you get into that rut, and pretty soon you just can't even remember what the issue was anymore. You may never get back to that position again. How do you know that you will ever be sitting there thinking, "Maybe I should call out to God tonight"? And this is why we read in the New Testament, he says, "Behold, today, when you hear his voice, do not harden your hearts." It's very important that we understand that whenever God calls to us, we need to say, "Yes. Yes, God." And I think those principles are all evident in this passage. So we'll draw the line there. All right. Who has a thought or a question to raise on any of this? Okay.
I loved all your arguments for creation and, you know, all the anthropic principle of all those things being balanced. And I was just listening to WOSU radio this week because Francis Collins, the guy, the scientist who wrote the Language of God book, he was interviewed on there. And he also said that one of the arguments that really convinced him about the existence of God is the moral argument, that we all have the sense of right and wrong in us, and it's hard to, you know, figure out where that comes from. It either comes from, you know, our herd instinct or God put it in there himself. And I thought that was interesting that he said that kind of goes in line with the Cain and Abel story. Because like when God was kind of like, you know, "What'd you do?" It wasn't like Cain was like, "I killed my brother, so what?" You know?
Yeah.
Like he knew, he acted all guilty because he knew it was wrong.
Good point.
You know? Yeah. So I just thought it was interesting that, you know, that was this, you know, great scientific mind that was one of the arguments that got him too.
Mm-hmm.
And
yeah.
You know, you can see it played out.
Collins is a big disciple of C.S. Lewis. He really likes C.S. Lewis. And if you've ever read Mere Christianity by C.S. Lewis, he develops that whole argument powerfully there. It's one part of a larger argument having to do with the features of personality that we see in ourselves, personhood, that suggests a spiritual dimension there that cannot be accounted for by natural evolution. And that is referenced also in Romans 1, that God made his nature and attributes evident within us, that we can look within ourselves and we realize, "I'm not normal. I'm not like another animal. Something special here." And that's the image of God that he's put in there. Yeah.
There's going to be a cool discussion, I guess, for free at COSCI this week on Wednesday, that Francis Collins and three other scientists are going to have some kind of panel discussion. Like, all you have to do is call COSCI and tell them you want to go.
Huh.
It sounds like it's going to be pretty cool.
Interesting.
So.
I may show up for that. I did not agree with Collins' conclusions regarding the Old Testament. He thought that the early chapters of Genesis could just be poetic myth. He didn't think they were historical at all. So that is, I'm afraid... Well, he's a scientist. He obviously is not a theologian, or he would know better than that. Jesus and Paul both said they are history. And so if we say they're not, then we're also basically breaking down the authority of Christ and the New Testament as well. Okay, I'm on back here.
Thanks a lot, Dennis. Throughout this Hebrew series, it's been wonderful to hear you teach, and each time I walk away with more, I don't know, my faith built up. And one of the things as you were talking that struck me was you talked about this whole matrix of things just for scientific evidence for God. And what is complementary to that, and seeing that, you know, out of all these religions, why would we pick the God of the Bible, is he has a similar matrix in the Bible that you alluded to. Here's this part in the Old Testament, which is confirmed over here in Hebrews, and all this other matrix is laid out in the Bible, and you can't separate it and piece it out. The longer I study and the longer I sit under teaching to take classes about the Bible, it just becomes evident, you know, in that similar way that
yeah.
God had this all planned out, including the way he wanted the Bible mapped out.
That really becomes clear when you study Hebrews here, yeah. The Bible is actually self-authenticating in an amazing way. And it's brilliant, but it works. Anything else?
Thanks, Dennis. I remember as a young Christian...
you know, spending some time thinking about what is it that God really wants in my life? You know, what's he want from me? What's most important to him? And one of the things I love about Hebrews and this chapter of Hebrews is that it answers that question, which is that God wants a walk of faith and trust on my part in him. You know, and it's no different, what I realize, it's no different having a relationship with him as a, you know, walking Christian than coming into a relationship with him. It's that same decision to trust God and put my life in his hands. So I find myself having to occasionally kind of do a check, you know, and ask myself, where am I walking right now in faith? You know, where's God challenging me to respond to him? And am I listening to that? So, anyway, but thanks for the reminder.
Good inner trust. That's what he wants more than anything. And he'll show you what actions should flow out of that. That won't be a problem. The key is, do I trust God with my life? We can detect, I think, at times that we're doing certain things that indicate I don't trust God, like we were talking about last week, when I sit around and worry all day, or when I am just totally unmotivated, when I feel sorry for myself. I must not believe the things that God says at those points, or I wouldn't feel that way. Well, okay, one more.
Well, I had a question, but I don't know.
Go ahead.
I don't know what the question is, so I'll ask you what the question is. I had a friend confront me, and it was really, you know, faith versus, I don't know, this live and let live attitude. And the question came down to, what do you live for versus... you know, as you get on in years, you're looking for retirement, and what are you looking for in retirement? Are you looking for, well, a lot of people are just looking for a place by the sun to lay down and die. It's amazing how many people are planning their life around that. And then there are these people who are going out and trying to witness to what's important. Well, what is important in your life? And, you know, this person made a statement to me, and that statement was that no life is a failure. And I said, well, how can that be? If no life is a failure, everybody dies and goes to heaven, and everything's hunky-dory then, and nothing matters then in what we do in life.
That's right.
And, boy, I just, when, you know, that bothers me when people think that way or say something like that. It just, I don't understand how they can be so callous, I guess is the word.
Mm-hmm. I think a lot of people want a life where nothing matters and I don't need to worry about anything, and also where we're all cool, so, you know, and that way we can just all, we don't need to really disagree or discuss anything, and everything's fine, you know, and that's not the way it is. And to say that no life is a failure, to have these hyper-optimistic views of humanity, it makes me think that people haven't thought about it very much. You know, I mean, how is Hitler's life not a failure? And there's so many examples we could cite. There's definitely a lot of raw evil in the world, and I even see it in my own life. To just assume that everything's cool with God, what does that say about him? How can he be cool with all of this? He's not cool with it. And so I think there's a lot of apathy, and you see this especially in American culture, where we don't want to think about the spiritual issues. It feels like, you know, well, whatever, you know, it's just, yeah, whatever. And so they were very apathetic, and I just want to enjoy my nice place and just watch my TV, and I just want to be, and I don't want to think about it. And that's not good enough. One of the things we discussed last week is doing nothing is not good enough. That's not faith. And God does, he's created us as thinking, choosing, free people. And he expects us to use that to move toward him and follow him. But I agree with you. It's kind of dismaying the way a lot of people just want to just gloss over everything and just like say whatever. Not good enough. Why don't we pray for a bit? God, we sense that evidence of your reality is all around us, and inside of us too. And I pray for the honesty, God, for all of us to face that, to act on it. And we thank you, Lord, also that we are not the playthings of our feelings and attitudes, but that, as you said to Cain, if we do well, our face will be lifted up. And so we want to form that intent in our heart too, God, to follow you and do well, regardless of how we're feeling at the moment. And we just trust that you will lift our faces up and restore our whole, you know, emotional well-being and everything. Thank you for that, Lord, in Jesus' name. Amen.
This study was recorded at Xenos Christian Fellowship and is copyrighted, but you may freely copy and distribute it as long as you keep it intact and do not sell it.